Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Thank you for spending your time with us this Sunday evening. Tonight, we jump headfirst into the biggest questions of all. Why are we here? What happens to us after we die? Is there life after death? Is heaven real? For centuries, these questions were the province of philosophers and priests. Here and there throughout history, hardcore scientists have embraced these mysteries as well, studying what some would deem to be supernatural or paranormal, or what others would call sacred and mystical. If you listen to this program on a regular basis or even infrequently, you know that mainstream scientists generally stay away from the paranormal like it was stink on a stick. It's all rubbish and pseudoscience and wishful thinking by people who are looking for meaning in their small, pitiful lives. And they're pretty harsh on their colleagues who stray outside the boundaries. Tonight, an academic who not only has strayed outside the boundaries, but has pretty much gone out of his way to obliterate the boundaries altogether. Jeffrey Kripal has been here before, and he never fails to give us a lot to chew on mentally. Tonight, he's back to talk about what could be his masterwork. It's a book that is filled with chilling and perplexing stories about encounters that humans have had with the unknown, and about our search to assign meaning to all of this. Some pretty famous humans, by the way, I might add, including Jeff Kripal himself. The questions we will address go right to the heart of what this program is about. Big questions, potentially disturbing answers. And along the way, turmoil, backstabbing, infighting, all that stuff that's associated with ufology and the paranormal world, and, you know, it's all good. Jeff Kripal joins me in the second hour and for the duration. Before that, Roger Marsh from MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, will be here with a UFO traffic report telling us about a host of recent sighting encounters and cases now under investigation. A couple of quick news updates before we bring Roger onto the program. Excuse me. Another night, another confrontation in Missouri. A curfew was again in effect tonight following 8 days of violence and protests, but a lot of good it did. The police presence in Ferguson was much less visible earlier this evening, that is, until a couple of hours ago when hundreds of protesters resisted police efforts to enforce the curfew. Molotov cocktails were lobbed at police lines, officers fired back with tear gas and rubber bullets, several people arrested. The protest tonight had been peaceful compared to the previous 8 nights of violence, unrest, and looting, but then erupted a couple hours ago. By the way, a total of 3 autopsies have been ordered for the body of Michael Brown. That's the young man shot and killed by a police officer 8 days ago, and that's the spark that set things off. In Iraq, Kurdish forces backed by U.S. warplanes are fighting furiously tonight to try and dislodge Islamic militants from a strategic dam in northern Iraq. The tricky part is getting the 400 or so ISIS fighters away from the dam without damaging or destroying the structure itself. Massive explosions were seen near the dam today, with buildings ablaze and smoke billowing into the air. Kurdish forces fired mortars and explosives as the battle to retake the dam raged on. If you're feeling a strange sense of stardust this weekend or thinking about getting back to the garden, maybe you're feeling the anniversary vibe of Woodstock. 45 years ago this weekend, on a farm in New York, Woodstock's art and music festival blossomed into a messy but endearing legend. 300,000 people, maybe it was 400,000, wallowing in the mud, enjoying great music, a celebration that sort of proved to be the high watermark for the counterculture movement. Things I don't think worked out like people back then hoped they would, that's for sure. 45 years ago this weekend, Woodstock. As usual, webmaster Lex and I have put together an accumulation of oddities and items from recent news reports. We post them on the Coast to Coast website under Knapp's News. Included tonight, a couple of stories with a scientific bent. one about a movement to fight back against corporate control of the seed industry, assuming you worry about such things, and many people do, me among them. Also, the views of a British scientist who thinks the Ebola virus came from outer space. He's not kidding. And we have a piece about the search for darkness, specifically dark skies. Some familiar locations have been added to the registry. We got a story about it. Also posted, three news items related to UFOs. One, a piece from Leslie Kane about how the government and military of Chile looks at the UFO mystery, quite a bit different than what we see here. We have a provocative story about Leah Haley. She's a pretty well-known alien abduction victim who has recently changed her tune about her experiences, saying aliens most likely had nothing to do with it after all. We thought it might be fun to see what you think about the whole alien abduction scenario. I mean, it's been featured on this program a whole bunch of times. Who's doing the abducting? Aliens, government, or something else, or no one at all? And we posted a poll on the Coast website. We'll see what you think. Check the results later in the program. Finally, on the site under Naps News, a story from a respected and talented writer. His name is Mark Jacobson. It was printed in New York Magazine, no less, based on his recent visit to the MUFON International Symposium that was held a couple of weeks ago in New Jersey. If you read this piece, you will notice that Mark quotes from me a couple of times, or rather quotes from the presentation I made at MUFON. The title of his piece, though, sort of belies the friendly and inquisitive approach that he presented to those he interviewed. The title is The End of UFOs, and the article seems to focus mostly on making fun of people who attend UFO conferences. Look, I have taken my share of shots at UFOs and ufologists over the years, but as generally as part of a larger argument that you have to see beyond the obvious, you know, to separate the wheat from the chaff, to get down to the core of this topic. I don't think ufology or UFOs is beyond ridicule, that you shouldn't be able to question it. I don't know if Mark decided, as so many Eastern media types have done in the past, that it is far easier to make fun of UFOs than to sort of do the homework necessary to take it seriously, or what. He's told other people in emails that his editors gutted his piece, that New York Magazine wanted above all else to make fun of ufology. And really, how hard is that, right? Big bad New York Magazine wants to make fun of the crazy saucer people. So maybe the editors did it. But I think Mark gave them the ammo, intentionally or not. I know they are getting a huge response to this piece, so chances are a couple of more pieces could be coming. I would just caution any of you out there who want to get interviewed by Mark about UFOs to be aware of what you say to him, because you have no idea how that information will be used. The story, as I said, I think it's well written. It is thought-provoking, but it is unnecessarily snarky and kind of a cheap shot, a shot below the belt, in my opinion. You can read it on the website under Naps News, and we might ask MUFON's Roger Marsh about his take on it as well. Roger joins me in a moment to talk about recent UFO reports and investigations. So let's kick this thing into high gear. We take our first break. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. Roger Marsh is a UFO writer producing daily UFO traffic reports for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. He's also MUFON's Director of Communications, editor of the monthly journal. He's worked for years in publishing, helping to develop hundreds of new books and magazines. His UFO writing can be seen at MUFON.com, at Open Minds TV, and as a blogger for Huffington Post. He's also currently a case researcher for Hangar One, the UFO Files. That's a show on History's H2 channel, which MUFON helps to produce. Roger, welcome to the program. Your first time, right?
Yeah, thanks, George, for having me on. I appreciate it.
Good to have you here. Before we jump into the current cases, I'd like to chat about this article that I mentioned in the introduction, The End of UFOs. The premise of the piece in New York Magazine, not very kind to MUFON. Not very kind to the recent symposium, sort of suggesting that, I was there. I thought it was a pretty successful gathering. The premise here is there's nothing new. It's all old cases. It's old people attending the conference in shrinking numbers. So you tell me, I mean, was it a success? Are the numbers down?
Well, I was interviewed by Mark Jacobson as well. Spent a good deal of time talking to him, and he really did. He said to me, "I believe in UFOs. I kind of took the piece that he was, and it could be his editors did hack him up, but I thought he was trying to make the point that in the early part of the 20th century, you know, maybe midway by the 50s, 60s, that it was this very innocent world of ufology. It was the, I think he said, you know, it was the simple flying disc that we were all looking at. And now, you know, come 50 years into the future, it's a very crowded, you know, marketplace out there. That now we've got not only the UFO, but we have, you know, alien abduction, conspiracy theories, you know, government cover-up, that sort of thing. But yeah, he did take a swing at us, I think, as far as, you know, hey, you know, we keep revisiting all of these old stories. You know, well, bring speakers in to do that. But I know he sat through my session, and I was hollering and screaming at the media to stop covering the old stories, that we have a mountain of research and cases like what I'll be talking about on the show tonight, that there are UFO reports coming in daily. We get 500 to 600 cases, George, every month coming into the MUFON organization that we follow up on. So it's out there, and I kind of pushed Mark that, you know, you have to go out and look for the stories. And my whole talk was about more how to train the media. I think, George, the problem is mainstream media just doesn't know how to cover UFOs. It's not that fire down the street that they could offer the public an address, a body count, you know, that sort of thing. It's not an easy subject to cover.
Well, that was sort of the whole theme of the symposium, is problems in, right, in getting media to cover it and treat it fairly. In part, it's a battle to first get them to take it seriously and then to do the research instead of just poke fun at it, which is what it just seemed to me that Mark took the easy way, or at least his editors took the easy way in poking fun at this stuff. When there is, if you do the work, you can see beyond it. I mean, to suggest there's nothing new. And there were some pretty interesting presentations there. There were some old guard people, but you got new folks, Ben Hansen and James Fox, exciting guys doing some pretty cutting edge work in films and research. And although, you know, I think it's a good thing that ufology and ufologists take a little somewhat, although the topic matter may have expanded a little bit, you take a little bit of a skeptical look at things. Skeptical, not necessarily snarky.
I agree. They should be skeptical, but they should be out there gathering information. And you know, I don't know, Mark. You know, maybe he'll come back for a follow up story and try to dig in a little bit more. But yeah, I just I think that I could speak for quite a few people within MUFON that it got a very bad response within MUFON.
Well, you know, and the other thing about, gosh, look at the numbers. There must have been thousands at conferences before. You know, if you're suggesting, if the suggestion is that there isn't a lot of interest in this, my gosh, man, how much bigger can it get? It's on television pretty much every night of the week on some program. And that is all competition for conferences. In addition, you have a conference pretty much every week somewhere. Every weekend there's a conference somewhere. It's more competition maybe than ever. And the problem for a MUFON is you guys are too serious. You don't let the crackpots and crazies get involved in making presentations.
Yeah, we're really trying to drill the subject down, and we have this, like I said, 500 to 600 reports coming in, and you know, we resolve probably 90% of them. You know, it's man-made or it's Mother Nature, and then it's that other 10% that we continue to study. I mean, there's a lot of room for research. We do need more funding in this field. That is one of the problems that MUFON's had. We've been around since 1969, and, you know, we're at probably, I don't know, 3,500 members right now, you know, nationally. We have a campaign going on right now to get more membership coming in, maybe developing student rates, you know, things like that. But, you know, we do need more manpower out there.
I have heard reports from China that they have UFO, citizen UFO organizations with tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of members. I don't know if that's an exaggeration or not. Maybe you have better. Is that true?
I have not heard that. I know most of my personal research as a writer, I've tended to focus myself domestically on what's happening.
Well, let's talk about some what's happening domestically. The idea that there isn't a whole lot going on, that we don't have the waves that we had in like the late 40s, early 50s, even into the 60s and 70s. Don't have those anymore. How accurate is that? How much activity are you seeing?
I have to agree with you, because in order to call something a wave, I mean, we have a plan within MUFON. It's just, you know, we don't throw those words around easily. It's a team of people, including scientists, that have to agree that a wave happened. And I've been with MUFON, you know, going on 6 years, and I agree with you. I'm not seeing the waves happening, because what you're going to hear tonight from me, it's just these objects are coming down, and I specialize in the cases under 500 feet. It's just very randomly around the country. But even if you go beyond, like, a lot of the waves from the past, like, I'm very familiar with the 73-74 wave that happened, and you had a lot of even consistency in the earlier waves, even in some of the shapes of these objects. But what I'm going to talk about tonight, there's going to be no consistency. I'm going to mention a sphere, a disc, a triangle, a teardrop. It just keeps seemingly it changes from report to report. Even if you just, George, just looked at the under 500 feet cases, and enormous objects too. I know back some of those waves from the earlier eras, you know, the 60s, 70s, whatever. I think we were seeing kind of, you know, minivan type of size UFOs, or something maybe a little bit larger, but we're getting frequent reports where the objects are, you know, a football field length long. Somebody will say 3 football fields. My God, it was a mile long. In fact, my second report tonight, I mean, out of Missouri, it was bigger than a house at 300 feet, you know, and 3 professional witnesses, one of them a retired pilot,
I'll tell you what, before we get into, we're going to take a break in about 3 minutes. So on the other side, we'll get into your traffic report.
Okay.
And just in speaking in general on the UFO topic, I mean, the fact that it's more complicated now, it's not as simple as flying saucers, that presents a special challenge. And it seems like it is always, doesn't it seem like it's always tantalizingly just a few feet out of our grasp? You know, it evolves to the point where we think we're going to solve it. We think we know what the answer is, and then it morphs into something else. I mean, that can't be an accident.
No. And the critics, of course, are screaming, everybody's got a cell phone. Where's the photography? Okay. You're going to hear a report tonight after the break. This is an Illinois policeman saying that about 15 minutes before this two huge objects appeared over him, his cell phone coverage went out on both his cell phone and his cruiser computer. Then all of a sudden the events happened. There were 2 other witnesses. We got great witnesses. All of a sudden the object moves away, and guess what? Boom, internet connection pops back up. We get constant cases where electronics are manipulated. Time and space is manipulated.
You can see, though, how somebody who doesn't want this to be true would say, well, gee, how convenient, you know?
Exactly. We can't cover UFOs the same way we cover a drought, a flood, a fire. You know, we need mainstream media, and we need the academics, the universities coming in to say, hey, how do we explore this? You know, we keep dragging the witness testimony in and putting it on the table and sifting it to say, hey, over on this table, this is really good witness testimony. You know, I've got a pilot and I've got 2 professionals who are describing an object bigger than a house at 300 feet. They're standing there, they're staring at it. And it's
well,
just
your job is to, I mean, you see more new cases than almost anybody. That's what you do. You see them, you assign them, you help investigate them, you categorize them. But are more cases the answer to solving this if it's always going to stay just outside of our grasp, understanding what the heck we're dealing with?
Well, we have to figure out how to get over that. We're not there yet, George. We're definitely not there yet. Each year, it seems like we're getting better at the collecting, the disseminating of it. Even the last year, just major media that I've talked to.
I'll tell you what, Roger, I'm going to interrupt you there. We'll get to your traffic report and some of the interesting cases you're working on after the break. We're talking with Roger Marsh from MUFON. Here's the signature song for Sergio Mendez from 1966. From 1973's Band on the Run, Paul McCartney just tearing it up, which is exactly what he did a couple of nights ago. I've been telling you that I wanted to see him on this current tour. You don't know how long the guy's going to be out on the road again. He's 72 years old. But I finally got to see him. It was at Candlestick Park, a beautiful, balmy night. Went with a group of family members, and it was absolutely terrific. Candlestick, of course, is where I grew up in that area. Went to see a lot of baseball games and my first football games and concerts. And this was the last event before they tear the place down. It was also the last place the Beatles played in America, the last full concert they did anywhere. And McCartney sent out Candlestick in style. Just an absolutely unforgettable experience. If he's coming to your town, you should go to see him. That's all I can say. I don't want to sell too many tickets, but man, it was a heck of a performance. And do yourself a favor and check it out if it's coming near you. We're talking with Roger Marsh, who's going to run down a whole slew of new cases coming into MUFON, UFO sightings, with some very credible witnesses right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Roger Marsh, the Director of Communications for MUFON, is my guest, and he has a UFO traffic report, some of the hot cases that have come into MUFON in recent weeks. Roger, give me the lowdown.
Okay. Like I said earlier, we get about 500 cases per month. I just looked back, and I pulled up 11 cases that were quite interesting that were pulled in or filed from the last month. And I just try to move through these quickly. First, I mentioned before the break, we had an Illinois law enforcement officer who was patrolling in Niles, that's a Chicago suburb, and he reported watching two silent, pulsing, red, sphere-shaped UFOs while he was patrolling in the 8700 block of North Milwaukee Avenue. That was about 11:15 p.m. July 3. He saw two pulsing, round red lights in the southwest sky, one on top of the other, which he thought at first was a cell or a water tower in the vicinity of Mary Hill Cemetery. And then one of the objects began moving slowly west to east. The other object followed in like a wingman-style formation, slightly behind and further south than the object. The witness, again, he's thinking, hey, this is helicopters. But he did park his squad car, shut the lights, engine off, got out of the car. And he stated, as soon as I got out of my car, I realized that these were not helicopters and were much further away and larger than I originally thought. There was no helicopter sound whatsoever in the relatively quiet night air and the presence of many airplanes in the sky. Now, these objects glided eastbound slowly, very deliberately. He described them as about the size of basketballs, but that's at arm's length, approximately five times the size of strobe lights on an airplane, with a shimmery white halo completely circling the sphere. He stated the red light was unlike anything I have ever seen, having a pulsing, almost liquid or living appearance and glowing rather than piercing the night sky. So, and he did find two other witnesses on the street with him on that. And also, before the break, I told you that that he lost internet connection about 15 minutes before these objects arrived, and immediately when they left his airspace, boom, internet popped up again. Moving over to Missouri, three Joplin, Missouri UFO witnesses spoke out this week about a sighting where the object was originally reported bigger than a house, traveling about 300 feet off of the ground. This was 9:15 p.m. July 8. The husband and wife reporting witnesses were traveling home when they noticed a man in the street trying to flag them down. And then this guy, by the way, is a retired airline pilot. So the first witness, the pilot, he's out walking his dog, saw the object. He flags this couple down, and they described it as off-white in color, appearing to be illuminated by a yellowish light coming from within. It was as big or bigger than a house and completely silent. Now, the husband, he stated it was boxy-shaped with multiple angles, kind of like a stealth airplane. It looked like it had darkened square windows in parts of it, flat on the bottom with round orange and red randomly flashing lights all around the bottom edge. The lights were round with a dark center like donuts. They were the size of stop signs. This particular story gets a little weirder because the three of them jump in this couple's car and they go chasing it. They believe that it may have landed in this field about a mile away. Now, they get to the field where they think it landed, but they don't see it. They're driving a Jeep, and all of a sudden, these bells start going off in the Jeep, like you don't have your seatbelt on or something. And then all of a sudden, he's in drive, pushing on the gas, but the car's not moving. So they've lost the ability to move with the car. So a couple of more minutes pass, they end up, boom, you know, it flips into drive, they move away, they're still looking for the UFO, they can't find it. They come back to that same field, same thing happens. All of a sudden, bells start going off, and they have no transmission. Just for a couple of minutes, scares them, and they get out of the area.
The idea that these things can affect technology, that they can knock out a camera or, in the cases of planes that have chased UFOs, knock out guidance systems, radios, that it plays into, as we mentioned before the break, it plays into the hands of critics who say, oh, gosh, how convenient. It knocks out any ability to track it or anything like that. But the fact is EMP-type effects are created by a variety of technologies, are they not?
Sure. I mean, we've had reports from the last year of an airplane pilot, you know, a single engine. It shuts all their systems down. We had a father and son, you know, up airborne. I think that was one of our top reports from 2013. But, yeah, it's incredible. It's hard to go up against the critics when you have all these variables.
I've noticed that, I've got an iPhone and try to take, we've had a couple of really dramatic storms here this summer, and you get out on the balcony during a lightning storm and try to take shots, video of lightning, and a lot of these lightning bolts will knock the phone out of sync. It'll knock it sort of out of the loop for a minute and knock it out of focus, and it stays out of focus for a couple of minutes. I would think if lightning can do that, then something more advanced might be able to as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. We just... Hoping we learn more about it.
Tell me this, Roger. You mentioned about a landing, that these folks thought something might have landed.
Yes.
When MUFON gets a case like that, what do you do? Do you send people or do you request that people go out and look around to see if there's physical evidence of something that actually landed in a field or wherever?
No. If we have a good case, we think we have good witnesses, it's a landing, we send our STAR team out. The STAR team is where we can get investigators and scientists on the ground within 24 hours.
And have they been out to this one yet? Do you know?
That I don't know. That was, we're going back to, this is the Joplin, Missouri case, you're saying.
But again, that was
investigated by Assistant State Director Margie Kay and STAR team investigator Larry Jordan. So they have been out to the scene. And I believe the problem with the field right now, they're trying to get permission from the landowner.
Oh, yeah, that becomes a problem. So it's not only finances to pay for somebody to go out there and do it, if in fact that is the case when you had to do it here, but it becomes a matter of access to land, where I imagine the same thing is faced by a lot of people who are investigating crop circles overseas.
Yeah, exactly, because we can't break laws as MUFON investigators. We have to follow the rules, and we just can't walk onto someone's lawn, you know.
You mentioned one of those cases was a couple of professionals, and I'm using air quotes around professionals, but can you tell us more about professionals like what, meaning people with college degrees or Can you give us more of a hint, or these witnesses don't want their identities known at all?
You mean the three Joplin, Missouri witnesses?
Yeah. Right.
Well, I can tell you the one is a former airline pilot. The other two have actually gone public with their names. And I know the husband, I believe, is a former police officer.
Well, high credibility there.
Now, but, yeah. But again, when I say professionals, just let's say business professionals.
But okay. What else? What other cases on your list? What's hot?
Well, we have a Dallas, Texas witness who reported watching a lighted triangle-shaped craft hovering about 1 mile in altitude that suddenly made a nosedive toward the ground level at Mach 1. that was 11 p.m. on June 13th. It was near the Hexter Elementary School. And again, this witness is saying, look, there was no proper FAA lightings on it. The object is circling. It's doing figure eights. It's hovering. It's rocking. And usually people will tell us that the UFO makes no sound whatsoever. That's kind of one of the creepiest things about them. In this particular case, it did emit a very faint, whirring sound, similar to an electric motor. And let's see, we had a Pennsylvania witness at Lewistown reported watching a silvery blue disc-shaped object hovering right over her neighbor's roof about 1 a.m. on July 28. The woman's outside with her dog. The dog takes up running. She hears another dog from a neighbor's pen who's whimpering. It was just a little unusual. But here's the witness statement. Okay, this is when we get these really weird cases. It's not just a disc. She said, the only way for me to describe it was it looked like energy. It wasn't solid, but not translucent either. I wasn't sure what I was seeing, whether it was from this universe or spiritual. A few minutes later, the witness said it was higher and further away. But she saw it, and all of a sudden it kind of blinked or skipped. She didn't see it move, but it sort of disappeared and then reappeared further away. And we do get that description once in a while.
I had, last time I was here, Roger, Jacques Vallée was my guest, and he talked about this amazing gathering of UFO scientists in Europe, and during which he made a proposal for the creation of a global database. Let's put all these cases together. Let's see what kind of patterns emerge. Mm. And I asked him this question. I'll give you the same question. Is, let's say you get more cases. You get 10,000 more cases. And then in your files, you have another 10,000 cases, but still don't have any answers. I mean, you have more information, but still the ultimate truth or explanation is still tantalizingly outside your grasp. Are more cases the answer?
Well, I think from just studying data, I think the answer is that we need more people helping us with research, more people coming in and saying, hey, I have an idea. I can analyze your data. Let's give it to this other study group, a research group over here. You know, we can only do so much with the staff that we have. More data is always good, the scientists will tell us. But we need people analyzing the data and trying to figure out what exactly do we have here.
Sometimes more data is not good. And when you're talking about, for example, you were talking about videos. Where's all the cell phone video?
Right.
You get all kinds of video, but it's so much of it is bogus. People creating stuff online using all kinds of computer software to create their own UFOs and then using that to draw traffic to their site or their YouTube channel or whatever. It creates, I can't imagine how many headaches it creates for MUFON trying to debunk stuff.
It does. Thankfully, it's a very, very small percentage of what we get in. I've had people try to hoax me directly, you know, get in touch with me, you know, hey, great case, look at this, you know, look at these photographs I have. You kind of develop after you've read, you know, thousands of these reports, thousands of witness testimony, you sort of develop this sense that you think you might be being hoaxed. But you're right. You know, And the public, especially the media, they tend to react to these videos that are going viral. And we're in a position where we're all looking at each other saying, oh, you know, we're analyzing these, 500 really good cases. And then all of a sudden everybody's talking about, some, sphere UFO hovering over this Florida retirement center swimming pool, it sort of drags us into it. It takes our scientists, our people away from the real work. And we look at it, we examine the video. In that case, that was a case from last year. It turned out to be water droplets on the lens.
Well, you get worse than that. You get hoaxes, people making this stuff up to get attention. And then the story goes all over. It goes viral. Boom, boom, boom. It's picked up on other media who then quickly debunk it and debunk the topic along with it.
Yeah, exactly. It just makes the whole field look awful, And we had nothing to do with it. We're over here doing the serious work. Somebody's creating these videos. And sometimes I say to myself, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. They're trying to, maybe get their foot in the deal with a film company to get something started. I don't know. I've seen some really good stuff.
I saw your most recent sighting statistics for July of 2014. You had the United States 750 reports for the month coming in from the USA. Is that an unusual number? Is that I would imagine it's larger in summer months because people are outdoors, but is that a big number?
It can fluctuate. We could even get 800-900 in, in a month, 1,000. July does include the 4th of July. And we get a huge hit the 4th of July week. That's the week I like to take off every year.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of people shooting off fireworks that are mistaken for something.
Exactly. Chinese lanterns, there's just so much of that activity going on. It's like, that's my week off. I don't want to cover, but it does affect the July numbers. They go up.
I noticed that number two on the list, and maybe this is the first time this has happened, but number two on the list country-wise is India. It's a distant second, but it's second, beating out Canada. Is that unusual?
I would say that most of what we focused on since 1969 is, of course, just domestic sightings, U.S. We are getting our name out there. I noticed the Canadian sightings are on an uptick recently. And here I'm talking to one of our directors up in Canada. He said they're running our TV show up there right now, and that's getting our name out there. Where do you go to report? India, again, I'm not really sure where that's coming from. We're not spending money promoting our name in India right now, but I know I fielded some inquiries from India on people who just want to be field investigators. What do they do? Who do they go to? And we have, in international, office set up so that if people could inquire to Dave McDonald's our international director. You probably met him at the symposium. Our former executive director, so he's pushing in other countries. But I've seen the India cases pop up, but I'm not really sure why.
You mentioned
huge
about the TV,
of course.
The TV show is on, and it's airing in Canada. And I guess it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? And on one hand, you want to get the word out, and if people have a sighting or a video or something, you want them to send it to you. On the other hand, I can see somebody saying, well, incidents aren't really up. Sightings are up because people are watching it on television, and they're thinking anything they see in the sky is a flying saucer.
Well, I mean, the same thing, George, happened here when we had season one of Hangar One last season, and that kicked off in, that was February of this year that it kicked off. We had an uptick in sighting reports coming in. But like you just said, we don't want, every balloon floating by. But I really think we got the word out there where people knew where to report. And we did get some great sighting reports in. Even when the numbers increase, you're always going to have that 90% of them we can explain. We're looking for that 10%. So the TV show is really increasing the number on the 10% side that's coming in.
And what's the outlook? You're in production now on season two, or it's already shot, or what?
We are shooting as we speak right now. Actually, this past week was our first shooting week, and shooting will go on probably for about, I think it's 2 months right now. And it looks like we're going to be, season two is going to kick off. Right now I'm hearing it's either January or February, 12 episodes.
Roger Marsh, good to have you on. We'll have you back again with another UFO traffic report here in a couple of weeks, and thanks for joining us.
George, thanks for having me. Good night.
All right, and now after the break, here we're going to get downright mystical here with Jeff Kripal, whose new book about comparing religions covers a lot of the stuff that we talk about on this program all the time. Bob Dylan, take us into the break.